Welcome to Newsweek on Air. I'm AP Network News correspondent Warren Levinson.
I'm Newsweek senior editor David Alpern. We have newsmakers and Newsweek correspondents to bring you these stories.
What's wrong at the White House? Is the new president drowning in a sea of triviality and ineptitude? Has the House thrown him a life preserver by passing his budget plan? We'll have some expert opinions and some poll numbers.
Good health. Is it as simple as ABC, D, E, and beta carotene? We'll look at the benefits and liabilities of America's growing passion for vitamins.
We'll also look into the Newsweek Periscope. First stop, the White House.
For a long time now, the American people have wondered whether their government in Washington could ever really work for them again, ever really face the tough problems. Well, tonight, the House of Representatives gave America a victory of growth over gridlock.
President Bill Clinton, after his hard-fought, narrowly won budget bill victory in the House of Representatives.
Inside the White House, there was hope that the win would mark the beginning of a turnaround for the president, or at least temporary distraction from the slings and arrows of outrageous trivia, the $200 haircut on the airport runway, a seemingly self-serving or maybe cousin-serving or friend-serving shakeup at the White House travel office.
But the hurdles facing Clinton remain high. The latest Newsweek poll shows his approval rating down to the Nixon-Carter-Bush zone of 36%, with 50% disapproving on the eve of the House vote. 55% still felt Clinton cares about people like them, but 56% say he's losing touch with the concerns of average Americans. And 49% say he lacks the ability to deal with problems facing his administration. Yet majorities still support the goals of his budget plan. 67% approve of tax increases to reform and expand health care, 60% to reduce the deficit, 56% to fund programs that stimulate the economy. And while 31% say Clinton is ruining his chances to be a successful president, a 67% majority disagree or say it's still too early to tell.
For our update on Clinton's wins and woes, we have senior editor Joe Klein, White House correspondent Eleanor Clift, and a former Carter White House press secretary, Jody Powell. He's now a Washington lobbyist. First, Joe Klein, what's your view of the budget plan victory? Was this awfully narrow, given that it's the Democratic House which is supposed to be most favorable to the president?
Well, sure it was narrow, but a victory is a victory. And as one Clinton advisor said to me, if we were going to be dead if we lost this, you got to give us a little bit of credit for being alive now that we've won it.
And what's your view of it in terms of content? What finally they did pass?
Well, I think that that it is pretty much according to the proposals that Clinton made during the campaign. He taxes the rich and the upper middle class, in addition. He helps out the working poor significantly with this $27 billion earned income tax credit, which is a really significant social program. And he takes a cut at some deficit reduction. I think that it may change some in the Senate, probably will. But the bottom line is ultimately that whether it passes or not, this isn't going to be the ultimate test of Clinton's presidency. It's how he handles the White House.
Are the problems with the various side issues, these things about haircuts, travel office, et cetera, are they seen as a staff problem or are they a problem at the center?
Oh, I think that the staff problem is a problem at the center. It's a recurring problem that Clinton has had throughout his career. You know, one of the standard management strategies in life is that you don't give people responsibility without authority, and yet he does it again and again and again. The good news, though, is that when he does it, he usually corrects it. And in Arkansas, he eventually found himself a strong chief of staff in Betsy Wright, who sat on his head for 10 years. In the campaign, he eventually found a strong chief of staff in James Carville, and in the White House, you know, there's rumors around that he'll find some stronger people there, too.
Joe Klein, thank you. For another view on that, we turn to White House correspondent Eleanor Clift. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
We understand that there is a search underway for someone who can be tougher than the current chief of staff and old friend Mac McClarty. How is that shaping up? Who's in the lead?
Harold Ickes, who was a campaign advisor and is a longtime friend of the Clintons, appears to be the front runner for this honor, if that's what it is. He was slated to go into the White House, but ran into some problems when he had legal difficulties in New York over his representation of a union with ties to organized crime, a difficulty that it is set around the White House will be cleared up in the next couple of weeks.
I know Ickes slightly. I think I remember him carrying a knife in his boot many years ago, but he's still seen as pretty liberal, isn't he?
That's right, and I think what you're seeing from the White House now is they're leaking a short list that includes also some other names, Washington insiders, old Democratic hands, even from the Dukakis, the Michael Dukakis effort. But I think what they really want to see is what the reaction is going to be to Harold Ickes. I mean, he's very identified with the liberal wing of the party. He's close to Jesse Jackson and the unions. He will make everybody who's worried that Bill Clinton is not a new Democrat, he will reinforce that worry.
But can a change at the top of the staff save the president? Doesn't the president have to save himself?
That's the message that's been delivered to the president, and he needs to disengage from some of the decision making that he's involved in. I mean, he gets down into the sheep dip, as we say at Newsweek. He's not managing the tennis court, but he's managing just about everything else, including, you know, every appointment, even at the assistant secretary level throughout the government. So he needs to have somebody around him that he feels confidence in, that he can turn over some of this. And also, he's got to let people discipline him. He's got the same sort of non-hierarchical staff setup that Jimmy Carter had. All lines lead to Bill Clinton. All decisions are made by Bill Clinton. But it's worse in this situation because Bill Clinton doesn't have the personal discipline that Jimmy Carter had. At least Jimmy Carter was on time for everything.
Last question. The Newsweek poll shows serious concern over some of these minor scandals, but you say the White House press is being tougher than usual on the president. Why?
Well, the White House press really has been the last group that this president has courted. In fact, he hasn't courted them at all, and he's let them know that he has alternative means of communicating with the American people and that he doesn't much like the institutional filter of the press corps in the White House. Well, they're getting their revenge. I think part of the coverage of the various peccadilloes over the last couple of weeks has been fueled by a desire to get even on behalf of the press corps. I don't think it's a decisive element, but I think it has made Bill Clinton's life a little tougher than it needed to be.
Eleanor Clift, thank you very much. Let's turn now to former Carter Press Secretary Jody Powell. Mr. Powell, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you.
You served a president on whom the press corps was awfully tough. Tell me, do you think the White House press corps is being tougher than usual on Mr. Clinton?
Well, they're being tougher than usual at the moment. There's no doubt about that. These things tend to go in cycles, and I've often said that I think journalists—it's when a president is already bleeding from one nostril and dragging a leg—that everybody piles on, and that includes journalists, members of Congress, you name it. It probably ought to be counter-cyclical. It's when a president's riding high that he's liable to make the big mistakes, and we ought to be watching more closely. But he's had a tough few weeks, and I think although the White House has made clear that they see some internal problems that they need to deal with quickly, that the degree to which a couple of these stories have become metaphors or examples of some larger, graver problem is a bit overdrawn. I mean, this guy really has, in fact, in the past 4 months, gotten us closer to serious reduction of the deficit that anybody has in the past 17 years. So let's give him credit for something here.
I wonder if all this stuff is not just a setup for the stories that are that could come later of the fabulous comeback stage by Mr. Clinton.
Well, I think he will be, if he gets this deficit reduction package through the Senate, and I'm inclined to think that he will, he may have to make accept some changes. But on the whole, it's in everyone's interest, Democrats and Republicans in this town, if they think about it for 2 seconds, to end up with a deficit reduction package that is credible and that the president can defend. And if it's not credible enough for him to defend, the public is not going to accept it as being effective, and they're all going to be in trouble.
Talking about the way the White House itself operates, I wonder if anybody in this administration is asking advice from the last press secretary in a Democratic White House, and if you have any, you'd be willing to share with us in terms of both imagery and the way it operates.
Let me say two things. One, I think one of the problems that you face from the inside of the White House when you try to reach out for advice is that all too often if you talk to somebody, you explain your problems, you discuss your options, you end up reading about it in the paper the next day, and that's unfortunate that you can't have confidential discussions, or it's hard to inside the White House. So I have a great sympathy for that sort of thing. And the other point that I guess I would make is that I've always thought, particularly people from former administrations offering public advice to a president was a little tacky and a whole lot presumptuous.
Well, Jody Powell, thanks for not being tacky, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking about wins and woes at the Clinton White House with senior editor Joe Klein in New York, where you hear us on WNYC. Also, White House correspondent Eleanor Clift in Washington, where we come to you on WTOP, and as well in Washington, former press secretary Jody Powell. Thanks to all again.
Still ahead, the Periscope.
But first, the new Vim and vitamins, when we return with more Newsweek on Air.
This is Tyne Daly. Listen. Hear anything? No, that's not surprising. The sound you don't hear is your liver hard at work. You can't hear it or feel it, but it's performing over 5,000 vital functions every minute of every day, keeping you alive and alert. It's the most remarkable non-complaining organ in your body, and it seldom gives you warning when it's in trouble. In fact, this may be the only warning you'll ever get. Learn how to take care of your liver. Write the American Liver Foundation, Cedar Grove, New Jersey, 07009.
Why does Mommy drink? Because sometimes I forget to make my bed. Why Daddy drinks? Because I fight with my sister. If I did better in school, maybe Daddy wouldn't drink so much.
Help them learn they are not to blame. Support the Children of Alcoholics Foundation.
Call 1-800-359-COAF or write Box 4185, Grand Central Station, New York, 10163.
It's Newsweek on Air. I'm Warren Levinson of AP Network News.
I'm David Alpern of Newsweek.
There's very little information about taking large doses of vitamin E for long periods of time. It probably is safe, but no one has that information. It's never been recorded.
Professor Joseph Whitstam of the University of California, San Diego, spoke here last week about two new studies that link vitamin E to lower risks of heart disease. And indeed, efforts to learn more about the benefits and dangers of E and other vitamins are increasing dramatically in labs around the country.
It's a trend that follows naturally from the soaring sales of vitamin supplements at drugstores and natural food centers from coast to coast. The latest Newsweek poll shows 70% of all Americans using vitamin supplements at some point, only a quarter never take them, and 15% of daily vitamin takers have picked up that habit in the last year alone. Three-quarters who take vitamins daily say the main reason is to promote general good health, but 23% say it's to prevent or treat specific problems, from heart disease to hair loss.
Another trend that follows naturally from increased vitamin use is stepped-up interest by federal regulators who fear food supplements may be less effective and more dangerous than consumers realize. In fact, there may be a congressional battle brewing over the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1993.
To talk about the new view of vitamins, we have medicine editor Jeffrey Cowley and Dr. Joe Pizzorno, a naturopathic doctor and founding president of Baxter College of Natural Health Science in Seattle, one of only two such accredited schools in the country. First to Jeff Cowley. Thanks for joining us again.
Sure.
Let's start at the very beginning. What is a vitamin, actually?
Well, a vitamin is simply one of 13 chemicals that are contained in foods that we eat, and our bodies use them in tiny amounts to build tissues, to maintain them, and to repair them.
How widespread is this new research on vitamins?
Well, my impression is that it's really exploding. You know, the NIH has recently announced that it's launching what it calls a bio-nutrition initiative. The National Cancer Institute is spending millions of dollars to support studies of specific vitamins in relation to various cancers. So there's really a lot of it going on everywhere.
And what vitamins and what diseases are coming in for the most attention right now?
Well, I think the real superstars of the vitamin revolution are the antioxidants. Those are vitamin C, vitamin E, beta-carotene. These are vitamins that we get in fruits and in green and yellow vegetables. And researchers have noticed for decades that people who live in societies where people eat a lot of fruit and vegetables have very low rates of the diseases that are so rampant in affluent societies, namely... Go ahead.
Now, you're talking about heart disease, cancer, et cetera.
Yes.
Now, we talked briefly, we touched on antioxidants last week. My understanding is that these guys go after something called free radicals. Explain how that works and why that's coming in for such attention now.
Okay, well, free radicals are simply molecules that have on them unpaired electrons. In say, a normal oxygen atom, you have... an atom that is ringed with pairs of electrons. A free radical is simply a molecule that has one electron that lacks a mate. It's very hungry to have a mate, so it starts stealing electrons from neighboring molecules. This sets off a chain reaction that can actually wreak havoc on cells. It can eat away at their membranes. It can screw up their genetic material. And the beauty of these antioxidants and vitamins is that they sop up free radicals. They sop up these extra electrons so that they actually stop this chain reaction from occurring.
How long is it likely to take before we know definitively what dosages of vitamins are actually safe and what are sufficient to be effective?
Well, it doesn't seem to me that safety is really a big concern with the basic vitamins. We know that vitamin A and vitamin D can be toxic in high doses, but the others are simply flushed from the body when we have too much of them. So I don't think that's a big issue. The coming up with the optimal dose of various vitamins, to figure out exactly how much you want to take in what combinations over what period of time to get what benefit, is a lot harder to do. There are now a number of studies set up to try to resolve those questions, and the people I've talked to suggest that in the next 5 years we're going to see a real explosion of data, and that it'll be really quite soon be possible to advise people much more specifically than we can now.
Jeff Cowley, thank you very much. For another view, let's turn to naturopathic Dr. Joe Pizzorno of Seattle. He's also on a U.S. Office of Technology advisory panel studying the safety of dietary supplements. Dr. Pizzorno, welcome to Newsweek on Air.
Thank you for the invitation.
What do you see as the most promising area of vitamin research right now?
Well, I think vitamin research can go, is right now going two directions. One is in the area of prevention, and that is clearly of great value. Recent research with vitamin E in the prevention of cardiovascular disease is exciting and confirms research that's been done for the last 30 to 40 years. The other area of value, I believe, is in people wanting to help take care of themselves better. And that is, people want to self-treat for a variety of minor illnesses rather than having to rely on a more expensive medical care system.
Such as?
Well, things like common cold, things like simple infections, taking care of minor skin conditions, of mild eczema and psoriasis and things of this nature. There are a lot of good nutritional approaches that people can apply themselves safely, and these are the kind of diseases that are in general not going to lead to more serious diseases, and people can work with their own body and try to promote their health.
Is there a danger that some people are putting too much faith in vitamin supplements as an easy alternative to the basics of healthy living, more exercise, less fat, no smoking?
You raise a very valid point, and that is you can't expect to take something from a bottle to replace something you're not doing in your regular life. A healthy diet focused on whole foods and a wide variety of whole foods, grown organically if possible, getting good regular exercise, living a less stressful lifestyle, which is, I think, kind of hard for most of us, living in an environment which was as healthy as possible in terms of limited environmental pollutants. These are all important components of good health, and they can't be replaced by something in a bottle.
What about the fact of people wanting to feel that they're taking their vitamins by getting them out of a bottle versus getting them out of their diet?
Well,
how much do we know about the difference between the benefits of vitamin supplements and vitamins from the food you eat?
Well, you ask another good question. We have both direct and indirect evidence in this area. Indirect evidence comes from such areas as research in the use of beta-carotene to prevent cancer. It's very clear that people who have higher levels of beta-carotene in their blood have a lower incidence of cancer. It's not clear, however, whether that's directly due specifically to beta-carotene supplementation or it's due to the fact that those people eat more vegetables that are high in beta-carotene. So some areas aren't answered. Other areas have been answered. I mentioned before the area of vitamin E. Clearly, getting more vitamin E by supplement than you can get in your diet does have a good preventive effect on heart disease. And frankly, you can't get enough vitamin E in your diet to have this preventive effect that the supplemental vitamin E.
Dr. Pizzorno, given the dramatic increase in sales of vitamin supplements, what's wrong with the Food and Drug Administration tightening health claims and safety standards?
Well, I think it's a situation of not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think this is an area which clearly needs to have regulation, and I think self-regulation is the place to start. Equally, I think we have to make sure that self-regulation is effective. One of the problems that's happened is because this is such an area with neither good public education nor a strong regulation, whether it's private or governmental, it puts the consumers in a very awkward position where they're trying to make decisions about their health without adequate information to ensure that those decisions are good. So what I would like to see happen is for the FDA work with the natural foods industry to establish good and consistent standards for product quality, for label claims, and for ensuring the proper education of the public.
How about the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act? What's in it?
Well, there are pending before Congress right now several different legislative acts, ranging from acts which are so restrictive as to eliminate much of what's in the health food store, to proposed legislation which is so broad that it would be virtually impossible to regulate what products are available on the shelves. So it's hard for me to respond to a specific act because there's such a wide variety.
What kind of regulation would you favor?
I clearly prefer industry self-regulation, but with the FDA looking over their shoulder, i.e., let the industry do it, have the FDA look at the regulation and self-regulation that they do, and ensure that it does indeed meet the public safety. We also want to make sure, as I said before, that the public becomes more educated. While claims can be made on labels, and I think appropriately, it should not be in the context of people not having other education about how to take care of themselves and how to utilize nutrition and herbs that are available in the health store or even from a person's backyard. People need to be educated, and I think we have to focus on this.
Okay, thank you. We've been talking about the new interest in and controversy over vitamins. On the line, medicine editor Jeff Cowley in New York and naturopathic Dr. Joe Pizzorno of Seattle, where Newsweek On Air is heard on KMPS and KLTX. Thanks again.
Next, the Periscope, when we return with more Newsweek On Air.
McGruff here. I want you to learn a song that tells people to say no to drugs. Users and losers are users that don't use drugs. Don't use drugs.
Come on.
If you know a user even part at a time, tell them to quit, take a bite out of crime. Users and losers are users, so don't use drugs.
Don't use drugs.
Now teach it to everybody and help take a bite out of crime.
A message from the Crime Prevention Coalition and the Ad Council.
6 months ago, a 12-year-old spraying paint on a brick wall had his first brush with the law.
Take it! Stop! Police!
Where do you go before things get out of hand?
All right, Picasso, in the car.
He got help at a youth center. They got help from the United Way. All because the United Way got help from you. The United Way, it brings out the best in all of us. A public service of the Advertising Council.
We're back with Newsweek On Air. What's in the Periscope this week, David?
Is former Secretary of Labor Lynn Martin positioning herself for a presidential run in 1996? A moderate, pro-choice Republican, Martin is crisscrossing the country now collecting political chits by campaigning for GOP candidates in New Jersey, Texas, and Montana. Even more telltale, some think, is her upcoming speaking tour of New Hampshire, the first primary proving ground. If the former Illinois congresswoman is serious about a bid, she'd be the first well-known woman to seek the GOP nomination. Here's another. If a new acceptance speech plan at this week's Tony Awards catches on, you may never have to hear actors thank their mothers, agents, or first-grade teachers again. Instead of rattling off the names of all the little people who made their award possible, nominees will be asked to submit a list, which will be shown on screen as the winners accept their awards. Producer Gary Smith hopes to shave 10 minutes off the notoriously long-winded show. That leaves time for more on-air awards or for more winners to promote their pet political causes.
Well, that would also leave some more time maybe for some scenes from the shows we'd like to see. It might be kind of fun, you know. Instead of them saying your name, you get your own credit right there on screen. With Newsweek senior editor David Alpert, I'm Warren Levinson, AP Network News, and this is Newsweek On Air with a word about 62930, something that we used to introduce a segment on network TV news last week without explaining it. For those of you who wrote in, 62930 is 30 seconds before the network TV news goes on the air at 6:30 in the evening. It's network TV shorthand for the deadline is at hand. We were trying to impress our guest. He doesn't appear to have heard it. If you heard something that you didn't understand, please drop us a note at Newsweek On Air, 444 Madison Avenue, New York, 10022. Newsweek On Air is a copyrighted co-production of Newsweek Magazine and the AP Radio Network.
Coming up on Newsweek On Air, human rights and commercial interests in China. What should Washington do?
The Marshall Papers. We'll discuss the content of and controversy over notes left by the late Supreme Court Justice.
Finally, look out, Sly and Arnold. A number of top screen actresses have decided that the road to mega hits and mega earnings is paved with shoot 'em ups and derring do. Call it the revenge of the femme fatale.
We'll also have the mystery quotes of the week.
This is a significant day. It is the first time that the president has attached human rights conditions to trade. It sends a strong and clear message of unified American determination to achieve change in China.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell of Maine praised President Clinton after he steered a middle course on most favored nation trading status for China. The Chinese got a one-year extension of MFN, but with strings attached.
The White House promised that if Beijing doesn't make significant human rights improvements, its status as an American trading partner could be revoked next year. The U.S. and China have become increasingly important markets to each other. American exports to China totaled $7.5 billion last year. Imports were nearly $26 billion.
Newsweek's Tom Masland looked into the growing Sino-American trade route. He's on the line with us now to talk about it, along with a human rights activist, Mike Gendrzyzik, the Washington director of Asia Watch. Tom Masland, given that China has become such an important trading partner with the U.S., McDonnell Douglas, for instance, wouldn't have sold any planes last year if they didn't sell them in China. Could President Clinton really afford to hold up MFN for Beijing?
Well, no, that was never really an issue. It was never anticipated that he would withhold it. The issue was whether he would set conditions and how tough the conditions would be.
And how tough do these conditions look?
Well, they're not as tough as the ones that the Democrats tried to impose under President Bush and that President Bush vetoed. They're more in the nature of recommendations that the Secretary of State needs to take into account in deciding whether China is making progress on these grounds, on these fronts.
Your story notes that it's kind of an annual affair in China, that as most favored nation status comes up in Washington, there's a flurry of human rights activity in Beijing and elsewhere in the country. How did that play out this year?
Well, since 1989, since Tiananmen Square, there's been a great deal of public awareness of this problem. This year, there was a larger business lobbying effort than there's ever been. As you pointed out earlier, the stakes are very high. At the same time, human rights organizations have made clear the continuing problems in China on human rights abuses.
Tom Masland, thank you very much. Let's bring Mike Gendrzyzik of Asia Watch into the discussion. Mr. Gendrzyzik, welcome to Newsweek on Air.
Yes, hello.
Did the Chinese get away with something this time?
Well, first of all, we welcome the president's announcement that human rights conditions are being attached to most favored nation trading status, and it's clearly now up to the government in Beijing to take the necessary steps to meet the conditions if they want to keep MFN next year. And that way, we're happy to see what the president did. At the same time, however, we do feel that there is some wiggle room, and there are some of the conditions that, the way they are stated, allow some loopholes, so that it'll really be very important to see how the administration pursues this in terms of getting Chinese compliance over the next year. I mean, the Chinese have to believe the administration is serious, that these conditions must be met, or they are in danger of losing MFN in a year's time.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the conditions that have to be met. What do they actually have to do?
Well, there are two set categories of conditions. First of all, there is a set of absolute conditions. In other words, the Secretary of State in his recommendation to the President next June must certify that extension of MFN will promote free immigration, which is now an existing condition actually in the law. And many political dissidents and others and their families are still having a great deal of difficulty getting out of China. Secondly, he must certify that China is complying with an agreement made last August 1992 between the U.S. and China prohibiting prison labor exports to the U.S., as well as allowing the U.S. to inspect prison sites. So these are absolute conditions that must be met. The second category covers a range of human rights conditions, in which the Secretary of State has to determine whether China has made overall significant progress. And this is where the definitional language gets a bit vague, but there are basically four or five points. One, that they are beginning to adhere to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Two, that they're releasing and providing an accounting of Chinese political prisoners. Three, that they're treating prisoners better. Torture is now rampant in Chinese prisons and jails. And one way they can do this is to allow international human rights and humanitarian organizations access to prisons. And finally, that they're taking steps to protect Tibetans' cultural heritage, as well as to allow international radio and TV broadcasts into China. I mean, as you know, China now engages in a rather aggressive program of jamming Voice of America broadcasts.
In Tibet, there was a very large demonstration last week that devolved into a riot in Lhasa, and defenders of the Chinese were saying, well, look, they've shown great progress. They broke it up with tear gas instead of bullets. What's your reaction to that?
I think it's hardly progress. I mean, my information indicates that many, if not most, of those demonstrating were doing so peacefully, and the Chinese have crushed any kind of peaceful expression of views on questions related to independence. They continue to hold hundreds of monks and nuns and other political prisoners, sometimes torturing them. I don't think they should be in any way rewarded for denying people their basic internationally guaranteed human rights to peacefully express their views. Yes, there was some violence, but this doesn't justify the Chinese trying to crush any and all forms of dissent.
The proponents of MFN say that increased economic ties and more capitalism in China inevitably brings with it democracy and human rights. And the Newsweek story talks about some interesting signs, the rise of talk radio in some of the bigger cities where people actually go and express their opinions on a lot of things, political stories in newspapers, a certain amount of additional freedom for people moving around to seek jobs. How do you see this interplay between economic ties, capitalism, and democracy and human rights?
Well, first of all, economic development is no guarantee of protection of human rights. And in fact, the Chinese government has said over and over again, most recently at their party congress last year, that they are determined to prevent economic reform from leading to political reform, that as they continue their openings to the West and encourage Western investment and trade, they are more anxious than ever to keep a tight lid on any expressions of political opposition. In fact, underground pro-democracy groups that tried to surface in China over the last year, thinking they now had space to operate, all were crushed and their leaders arrested and rounded up. Clearly, they are in a position, however, through their economic reform program, of trying to establish their credibility and popularity with the Chinese people. And this is why the MFN trade relationship is so vitally important to the Chinese government. Without this kind of trade, they simply cannot maintain their existence and their control. This is what gives the president such enormous leverage in using MFN. The Chinese government is desperate to keep this trade and investment going in order to keep its credibility intact with its economic reform program.
In a word or two before we go, since we're out of time, human rights in China better than Tiananmen Square or worse right now?
There's been no fundamental improvement in human rights whatsoever over the last 4 years. All the repression that began with Tiananmen has continued, and we don't think there will be any change until the kind of international pressure is brought to bear that will force China to uphold its international human rights obligation.
Mike Chendrizek, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking about the debate over Chinese human rights and trade policy with Newsweek's Tom Masland and Mike Chendrizek, Washington Director of Asia Watch.
Now for a quote from the news. It looked as if it had been raining glass.
We'll tell you who said it after our last story about action movies where the hero doesn't get the girl. The hero is the girl. But first, the Marshall Papers and embarrassment at the Supreme Court when we return with more Newsweek on Air.
The Army National Guard. It's men and women trained to be their best. It's Americans committed to the ideal of the citizen soldier. It's our neighbors, the ones dedicated to defending our freedoms and protecting our way of life. Like the father of three who served on the front lines during Desert Storm, or the accountant who spent last weekend with her unit destroying tons of illegal drugs, stopping them from reaching our streets. Or the student who took 2 weeks in the summer to help rebuild a flood-ravaged town. The Army National Guard is all of these people. People like you and me. Strong, dedicated, capable, honest, proud. And they will always be here, serving the communities they're a part of, just as the Army National Guard has been doing for over 350 years. The Army National Guard, Americans at their best. Become the best. Call the Army National Guard at 1-800-638-7600.
For some kids, the hardest thing about school is the walk home.
Yo, kid, wanna get high? What's the matter with you? You scared?
And it's not just the bullies or drug dealers. Sometimes it's just a matter of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Every day in this country, thousands of children, just like yours and mine, are victims of violent crime. But it's not hopeless, not if you do something now. Start by calling 1-800-WE-PREVENT. You'll get free information on how to stop the crime and violence in your neighborhood, and you'll learn how to create a community that cares. You can fight back. Don't let your children grow up scared. Call 1-800-WE-PREVENT today and help take a bite out of crime.
A public service message brought to you by the Crime Prevention Coalition, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Ad Council.
We've got more Newsweek on air for you. I'm David Alpern of Newsweek.
I'm Warren Levinson of AP Network News.
Everything has to come to an end sometime. And I have given 50 years to it. And if that is not enough, God bless him.
2 years after his retirement and 5 months after his death, civil rights champion and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall was still making a contribution to legal history last week. His private papers, recently made available to scholars and journalists at the Library of Congress, provided fresh glimpses of the High Court's operations and stirred a storm of controversy over the decision to release them and the damage they might do.
To discuss the controversy and the content, we have Justice Editor David Kaplan and syndicated columnist Carl Rowan, a longtime friend of Justice Marshall. We talked with him last February about his biography of Thurgood Marshall. David Kaplan, you first. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you.
In general terms, what would you say is in the Marshall papers that sheds light on our knowledge of the operations of the court?
There are a bunch of cases over the past quarter century that we learn some more facts about. Certainly the abortion cases, some of the death penalty cases, affirmative action. There are no truly startling, groundbreaking pieces of news in all this. The Marshall papers are not the motherlode of information that other papers from other justices have been. But certainly we find out, for example, that in the Webster abortion case in 1989, the justices almost overturned Roe v. Wade, the landmark abortion decision, and that it was only Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's about-face at the last minute that saved Roe. Now, there have been hints about that in the press, and if you read between the lines in the Webster opinion, you get that sense. But here, confirmed for the first time in internal memoranda, do we know that.
And what about some of the other issues, homosexual rights, for instance, and the death penalty?
Well, we find out in gay rights, for example, we learned that Lewis Powell in 1986 was wavering about which way to go. He eventually decided that there was no constitutional right to engage in homosexual acts, and that he wrote in private memoranda that's because this was deviant behavior. But Powell has largely said that in speeches given since he's retired as a justice, so this doesn't come as any great shock. In death penalty cases, we learned that Marshall was an ardent opponent of the death penalty, which we already knew, and we learned that he wanted to add some language and opinions, really going after the majority in a less genteel way than we typically see in Supreme Court opinions. But again, none of this is particularly earth-shattering.
And what about the human aspect of the court revealed in these papers?
We see Marshall's wit, his very dry sense of humor, the fact that his favorite words seem to be no. No to this interview, no to this lunchtime gathering with some school children. But that kind of charming curmudgeonliness has been something that certainly you ask Carl Rowan, he'll tell you that. But we've known that about Marshall his whole life. I think the big news this week was all the controversy surrounding this. Now, sure, this is
well exactly that. Given that there are no great revelations here, what accounts for the court's agony over this?
Well, you know, the court, for all of its ardent support of the First Amendment and free expression and so forth, jealously guards its own secrets. And this is the first time a justice's papers have been released so close to the time that the justice served on the court. Marshall retired in just 1991, and the justices don't like being examined this way. They think their internal discussions and debates ought to be private, and the Marshall family feels that this is in direct breach of what Justice Marshall wanted all his life and what he told the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress says that, no, this is exactly what he intended. That's what all the uproar has been about this week, and you can understand where the Marshall family is coming from, and yet, given that this paints the court in a very favorable light, this is a very deliberative, careful bunch of judges, and that it certainly doesn't make Marshall look bad, you kind of wonder why there has been as much sound and fury as there's been, but Carl Rowan will tell you something about that.
David Kaplan, thank you. For a personal view, we do now turn to syndicated columnist and Marshall confidant Carl Rowan. Welcome back to Newsweek on Air.
Well, thank you very much.
What makes you think your canny, curmudgeonly old friend didn't mean to cause just this kind of stir by letting his papers become public, as he said in that contract, whenever the Library of Congress determined?
Well, I think he really intended to give the papers at the discretion of the librarian, but I will never believe that he intended for them to come out 4 months after his death. Why would a man give up more than $250,000 in a book deal because he wanted to protect the integrity of the court, and then turn around and tell the Librarian of Congress that he could release all these papers in a helter-skelter way?
Isn't that just the point, though, that there was now no profit in it for him, and he could do it, he could have it done on its own merits?
The fact was that there is no evidence whatsoever that he asked the librarian to do this. His administrative assistant was in the room, except for answering a couple of telephone calls. She never heard the justice say, release them, quote, upon my death, unquote, as the librarian now contends. His wife had no notion that this happened. His sons had no notion. His lawyers and best friends had no notion. The four law clerks who worked with him at the time he was talking to Billington never heard anything like this, and I don't believe he ever said it.
Mr. Billington's the Librarian of Congress. But given, as we've just been talking about with David Kaplan, that there aren't bombshell kind of revelations in these papers, is this really a problem?
Oh, well, that's another issue. I mean, I, for one, I'm not for having this stuff revealed. I'm the guy who blew a book deal by insisting that he talk about these issues. That is not the question, and I am not one who believes that the court is grievously damaged by these revelations. I am interested primarily in the fact, in the question of whether the Librarian of Congress did a number on this justice of the sort never done to anybody else on the Supreme Court.
Okay, but let's put the controversy aside for the time being. What particular disclosures from the papers did you find most interesting about issues or other justices or Marshall himself? Which do you wish you'd had for your book?
Well, I haven't seen anything. I've got stuff in my book far more interesting and far more revealing than anything I've seen come out. The big quote on page one of the Washington Post the other day about blacks not getting into the pot or not getting melted down, that was in my television show of 1987 with a justice saying it himself. So it has nothing to do with what I wished I had or anything. It is a question of the integrity of the Library of Congress in dealing with Thurgood Marshall.
Carl Rowan, thank you very much.
You bet.
We've been talking about the release of Justice Marshall's Supreme Court papers. On the line, Justice Editor David Kaplan in New York and syndicated columnist Carl Rowan in Washington. The book with all those revelations is Dream Maker, Dream Breaker, The World of Justice Thurgood Marshall. Thanks to both again.
Now it's time for our second mystery quote. She's not great at washing. Her house is filthy. We'll tell you who said it after our last story. Fierce, fast, often foul-mouthed, and female. We'll take a look at the new wave of action movies starring women when we return with more Newsweek on Air.
This hasn't been the best of days. You're burned out and you're bushed. But when you get home, there'll be someone waiting there whose workday isn't over yet. Your kid. Maybe his homework is overwhelming. Maybe he's a slow reader and it makes him feel dumb. Maybe he thinks everyone is way ahead of him in math. Maybe he thinks you don't care one way or the other. Sure, you deserve to relax, but there's nothing more important you can do in the next half hour than sitting down with your kid and asking how his school day went. Ask him to show you what he learned today. Ask if you can see his teacher. Don't give criticism, give support, and praise him. Do it. Let him know you believe in him, that you know he's got what it takes. You don't have to be a genius to keep your kid on top of his schoolwork, but you do have to be there for him. Because if your kid thinks you don't care, he won't care. Then he won't learn. Show me a parent who really cares, and I'll show you a kid who can learn. This message is from the Education Commission of the States and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead, and we've traveled all over the world, from Amsterdam to the Great Pyramids of Egypt. But I can't think of anywhere more full of beauty, life, and music than our own national forests. I love the forest. But you know, All its beauty can be taken away from us through one careless act. A campfire unattended, a cigarette butt thrown out a car window, or a trash fire left alone. You see, one little fire can quickly become one big fire, a forest fire. And before you know it, the trees stop swaying, the flowers stop blooming, and the birds stop singing. So please, be careful in the forest. It belongs to all of us, and remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
A public service of this station, the Forest Service, USDA, your state foresters, the Ad Council,
and the Grateful Dead.
Manicures and Muscles time. It's Newsweek on Air. I'm Warren Levinson of AP Network News.
I'm David Alpern of Newsweek.
You broke my arm.
There are 215 bones in the human body. That's one. Now don't move.
If you like Linda Hamilton as the two-fisted, tough-talking, trigger-tugging heroine of Terminator 2 or Sigourney Weaver in the Alien series, have we got news for you. Producers all over Hollywood are looking for gutsy gals to star in a surprising number of female action movies, now on its development roster.
For the movie makers, the phenomenon is both politically correct and a potentially profitable new turn on a genre that may have gotten a wee bit familiar in the hands of Schwarzenegger and Stallone, Eastwood and other free-firing Hollywood hunks. For the actresses, there's the hope of bigger-than-ever box office sales from the sort of shoot-em-ups that are most easily understood and marketed in cultures around the world.
To talk more about the new breed of femme fatales and the movies themselves, we have Los Angeles correspondent Charles Fleming and producer Denise DeNovi, who's making a Die Hard-type film called Trackdown with Jodie Foster and the yet-to-be-cast female Western Outlaws. Her previous films include Heathers, Edward Scissorhands, and Batman Returns. Charles Fleming, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Besides Jodie Foster in Trackdown, who are some of the other actresses we can expect to flex their pecs in movies coming up?
Well, probably the biggest of them so far is a picture called Mistress of the Seas, which is going to star, presumably, Gina Davis. Paul Verhoeven, who directed Basic Instinct and Total Recall, is going to direct it. People are talking about a budget of upwards of $60 million. It's a story of an 18th century piratess who rules the seas.
What's the inspiration for all these?
I think the inspiration is twofold, as you mentioned. First of all, I think producers realized that after all of the 48 Hours and Lethal Weapons and Diehards, that people are getting a little tired of this genre. For an example, look at Last Action Hero this summer, where they're taking the genre with the guy that almost made it the most famous of all, Schwarzenegger, but they're kind of making a spoof of it. They're realizing that it needs a shot in the arm, and I guess the cliche here is that they may be looking for a shot of estrogen to perk it up, to try and put some women in these pictures. One of the things that seems to have convinced Hollywood that this works very well is that they took a little picture about baseball and released it during the summer when mostly boys go and buy the movie tickets, but they cast it with all women and called it a league of their own, and it went over the $100 million mark. That's convinced them that if you make a good picture, it doesn't necessarily matter if it has women in it. In fact, that can be the twist on it that makes people really sit up and pay attention.
Are many of these pictures actually old male action vehicles that have been rewritten for women?
That has been the case, and in fact, it's gone the other way, too. There was a picture that was being planned over at Warner Brothers that was going to star originally Michelle Pfeiffer. It got rewritten a little bit so that it would be better for Gina Davis. Both of those actresses ultimately passed for it, and now the new star of it in a movie that's going to be called Dead Reckoning and go into production next year is Steven Seagal.
And he doesn't have to wear a dress.
No, but I guess he'll probably keep the ponytail.
Okay, Charles Fleming, thank you. We turn now to producer Denise DeNovi of DeNovi Pictures. Welcome to Newsweek on Air.
Oh, thank you very much.
What do you see as the most important reason for this sudden spate of female action films?
Well, I think it reflects a lot of what's going on in our society and our culture right now, in that there's a resurgence of feminist energy going on. I think it's evident in politics and in our culture at large. I think having Hillary Rodham Clinton being our first lady is probably the most evident symbol of that right now. And I think having reproductive rights be in jeopardy, be in such great jeopardy in the last couple of years has re-energized people's feelings about these issues.
What about a predictable complaint from at least some quarters of the feminist movement that this is using women to portray the same old male macho sensibilities?
Well, I don't think that's true. It may be true in some cases, but in the films that I'm trying to make, I don't feel that that's accurate. I think we're trying to have women be in situations that are as heroic or as interesting or as dynamic as many of the male roles have been, but we're definitely putting a feminine or female spin on it and making them real and accurate in terms of what women would do in these situations.
Is there a real difference in an action picture that would be starring Jodie Foster as opposed to an action picture that would be starring Clint Eastwood?
In mine, the one I hope to make there is, and I think there should be. I think when women are put in these situations, I think they probably call on a lot of faculties that men don't have or that we have in different ways, such as women's intuition, perhaps a greater sensitivity when it comes to violence or ambivalence when it comes to violence, greater commitment to certain things that are important to us. So I think that's what's going to make these films so interesting. I don't think it's accurate that when women are put in difficult or action situations that they simply hobble along on a broken high heel and ask for a man to come and save them, which is but what we've been dealing with for the last 40 years.
Is it difficult getting some women actresses, some actresses, to take on these physically demanding and psychologically more aggressive roles?
Oh, they're all dying to do it, and I've spoken with probably most of them, and they're just ravenous for these roles because, you know, men have gotten to do all this fun stuff all these years, and most of the women are very capable. And the Michelle Pfeiffer that I worked with in Batman Returns, who played Catwoman, was just phenomenal in the physical training that she did and what she was capable of doing in terms of her own stunts. I think she did more of her own stunts than most men have ever done.
Thank you very much. We've been talking about a coming wave of women starring in Hollywood action films. On the line, correspondent Charles Fleming and producer Denise DeNovi in Los Angeles, where Newsweek On Air comes to you on KMPC, KRTH, KIEV, and KBIG. Thanks again.
Now it's answer time in our weekly news quote quiz. It looked as if it had been raining glass with Stefano Toselli, an assistant curator at the famed Uffizi Gallery in Florence, after a massive car bomb blast killed at least 5 people, destroyed or damaged 20 paintings, and blew body parts off various statues in the world's most important collection of classic Italian art. The explosion also escalated tensions already running high in Italy because of a 15-month scandal implicating the country's political and financial elite in widespread corruption and alleged links with organized crime.
She's not great at washing. Her house is filthy. That was British journalist James Whittaker, author of a new expose of Britain's royal family, talking about Camilla Parker Bowles, reportedly the mistress of Prince Charles. I sort of feel that's an antidote for His Royal Highness, for his very pristine upbringing with nannies cleaning everything, Whittaker explained at a news conference, time to compete with yet another royal rose just published by London columnist Nigel Dempster. Now it's time for us to clean up and out for another week after welcoming your questions, compliments, and criticism. While you scratch up pencil and paper to take down our address, let us acknowledge kind words from Houston listener Robert Temple. He calls Newsweek On Air an intellectual stimulant, but says he thought our discussion of new food safety problems should have mentioned the benefits of new food irradiation techniques. What's on your mind? What do you think of the program? What station do you hear it on? Write to me, David Alpern, at Newsweek On Air, 444 Madison Avenue, New York, New York, 10022. If you'd like a cassette of this week's broadcast, please send a check for $5 made out to Newsweek On Air.
Newsweek On Air is a copyrighted co-production of Newsweek Magazine and the AP Radio Network, recorded at the studios of WNYC in New York.
Produced by John Benet and Janet Bayless.
Our engineer is Lance Neal.
I'm David Alpern of Newsweek.
And I'm Warren Levinson, AP Network News.